This is a podcast about Jeopardy!
Hello and welcome to Potent Potables, your weekly Jeopardy! Podcast where two former competitors bring you recaps and analysis of the week's Jeopardy! Episodes, a deep dive into a topic inspired by one of those episodes, and a quiz. I'm Emily.
And I'm Kyle, and this is the week of April 17th, 2023. We had an interesting start to the week, and really just a week of Jeopardy! Episodes, which, as we discussed last week, there were five. And we will discuss them.
Exactly five.
No more, no less. Although that is going to change in a few weeks when the Jeopardy! Masters tournament starts. But I don't know how we'll handle that. But we'll handle that when we get to it. For now, Emily, how are you doing?
I am doing well. Thank you. My children are having extracurricular activities, like big kids, which is wild. My daughter had her first ever theater performance today, and she was great. And she cried herself to sleep because now her show is over and it'll never be the day of this show again, which that's how I felt after taping Jeopardy, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had an emotional moment when my last episode aired.
Yeah.
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 There's a big letdown, for sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that's a mood. And, you know, Little League is Little Leaguing. And I am living through my children, I guess, is the TLDR here. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. My kids just started a dance class. My older daughter was in dance a couple years ago, and then she broke her leg falling off the monkey bars.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
And we just didn't get her back in until now. And so now the little one and the older one are in the same dance class, and it's very cute.
That's so cute. Is there a particular style of dance they're doing?
It's ballet and tap, like you know, little kid ballet and tap.
Yeah. So
it's adorable.
Nice. That's great. Any video game update?
Alas, no. I don't think I have played a moment of video game since we last talked.
Yes.
I am too busy trying to figure out how to make JavaScript work.
Yep.
And it's stupid and dumb and necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh, JavaScript. So. I say that as if I coded in JavaScript at all, which I don't. I have done a tiny bit of not very useful coding in my life, but not in JavaScript. I, on the other hand, have played a moment of video games.
Such as?
I have played a ton of Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, which is so good. It's so good. It's so good. Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild 2 comes out in like 3 weeks. Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So I've got to play a lot of moments of Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild 1 if I'm going to be on track to
glide right in.
Yes. I see what you did there. I am presently, I have died 4 or 5 times trying to fight my first divine beast, if that's
meaningful in any way.
Yeah, if that means anything to anybody, that's the situation. I'm trying to avoid spoilers, which is difficult because there's a 9-year-old who lives in my house and just walks into the room, blurts out 7 spoilers I didn't ask for, and walks back out. Except, no, he doesn't walk back out. He stays. He stays and gives more. I'm like, you've got to stop, friend. This needs to end. He's like, go left. I'm like, stop.
Stop telling me. I want to discover. Let me explore. Let me make mistakes. That's part of the fun. Yeah.
Nope. He will not have it. He's already made the mistakes, and he's going to explain to me everything that I should do.
You know, that is a corollary to parenting, though. As a parent, I desperately want my kids to just do what I tell them and not make the mistakes. But of course, the problem is they have to make the mistakes.
Right.
Which then, really, the question arises, what is the point of parenting at all, then? If they are not allowed to learn from what I have learned, you know?
It's a good question.
Anyway.
Anyway.
We have some Jeopardy that we are obligated by law to talk about.
This is ostensibly a Jeopardy podcast, so we should probably talk about Jeopardy.
Yes, we have to keep up appearances at the very least. So, on Monday, April 17th, we have the contestants, Madeline McKenna, an attorney from Los Angeles, California, Daniel Shiraki, a writer from Baltimore, Maryland, and Tony Van Kampen, a retired systems analyst from Mount Prospect, Illinois. Notably, none of these are named Ben Chan, because Ben Chan had an illness, which mm-hmm. made it so that he could not return to defend his title. Mm-hmm. Apparently, this is the fourth time in which the reigning champion did not return, since the limit was taken away. He will return May 15th, according to the Jeopardy fan. Is that what I read? I'm trying to remember mm-hmm. what I read.
Yep, that is correct. Yes.
Yeah. So we will get more Ben, which is good because he's a very dominant player. It would be a shame if he weren't able to, you know, keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have three new contestants, no defending champion. And we have the Jeopardy round categories, Texas state symbols, in the bookstore, body language, measure for measure, non-bomb rom-coms, and ends in silent E.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that we should talk about Jeopardy, but all I want to talk about is the $1,000 level of In the Bookstore. The title of Gabrielle Zevin's novel about young game designers is this repetitive line from Macbeth expressing weariness. Madeline tried, what is tomorrow, tomorrow, and tomorrow? That is not quite correct. It is tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. I am reading Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow right now. It is so good. It is so good. Nice. Oh, it's great.
It's about young game designers. Is it just like a real world fiction story about people yes. who are making games?
Yes, it is. Okay. It is realistic fiction. Gotcha. About some young people who get to know each other during childhood and their friendship over the years as they become game designers and design a game together. Games together. Yeah, I'm about halfway through. It may be the best book that I read this year.
Nice.
I think it's better than anything I read last year.
Wow.
Yeah, awesome. It's a solid one. This is a recommendation that is all over the place in my friend circles. So maybe everybody who is listening to the podcast runs in similar circles and has already heard this recommendation a gajillion times. But on the chance that anyone has not had this book recommended, it is great.
I will put it on my list.
That's good. You should. That is the main thing I wanted to talk about in this round, because that book.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I did not expect Love Actually to have the staying power that it's had. It came up at the $400 level of non-bomb rom-coms in 2022. Diane Sawyer interviewed Hugh Grant, Laura Linney, and much of the cast of this film 20 years later. Madeline got that one. And like, Love Actually, it's okay.
Yeah, why does it?
I don't
know. Is it just because it had a really good cast?
It did have a really good cast. It could be that we're having a really hard time. We keep trying to make new Christmas movies.
Mm.
And
at a certain point,
none of them are quite really like name a great Christmas movie that's been made in the last 20 years, right? Like, I'm hard pressed. Even the ones that have caught on from like the 20 years prior, like The Nightmare Before Christmas is kind of a Christmas movie. The Santa Claus, was it good? Or was it just ubiquitous? Hard to say.
I feel that. Love Actually feels like it had like the memorable moments that had become pop culture kind of like touchstones.
Yeah.
But did that make it good?
Yeah.
Like the cards at the doorway thing?
Uh-huh.
Like I know things about it, but I don't really remember the movie itself all that much.
Yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Apparently, we're just going to rag on Love Actually.
It deserved it. I think Lindy West wrote like a takedown of Love Actually that was pretty solid. Was it Lindy West? Let's see. Yeah. I rewatched Love Actually and I'm Here to Ruin It for All of You by Lindy West from 2013, 10 years ago.
And that was when it was 10 years older.
Yes, it was already 10 years old at that point. It was already 11 years old at that point because this Jeopardy clue referenced a 2022 interview for the 20th anniversary.
Mm. Now, if you want an actual good movie, you just go down to the $600 level. You must remember that in 2008, Jason Segel tried forgetting this Kristen Bell character by heading for Oahu. That's Sarah Marshall. Forgetting Sarah Marshall. It's very funny.
Okay. I haven't seen Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
I mean, it's still a rom-com, so it's got some of the typical mm-hmm. tropes.
That's fine.
You can predict the ending from the start, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it is very funny, and it introduces Jason Segel's Muppet Dracula musical.
Huh?
Which, if nothing else, that alone is, like, absolutely worth it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very funny. Also, nice. The breakup scene is apparently, like, taken from his real life, where he was broken up with while he was completely naked.
Wow.
You should see it. It's very fun.
Okay. All right. I'll put it on my list. Daily Double number one is in the bookstore at the $600 level, and Tony finds it. It's pick number 14. She's at 1200 with Daniel at 2400 and Madeline at 3000, and she makes it a true Daily Double and gets the clue. This title of Prince Harry's memoir completes a description of Prince William and him, the heir and the, and she gets it correct, the spare.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That book had some viral moments.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Anyway, at the end of the Jeopardy round, Tony's in the lead. That Daily Double helped her out some. She's at 5,200. Daniel's at 3,200. Madeline's at 4,600. The Double Jeopardy categories are the 12th century, world geography, three-syllable verbs, alphabetically first, TV before and after, and gods and myths. We didn't get to all of the clues here. We left two $2,000 clues on the board.
We did. One was in the myth category. The other was 12th century. I really like the $1,200 clue of the gods and myths. Not just a Fleetwood Mac song in Welsh mythology. She was a goddess unjustly accused of killing her own son. That's Rhiannon, which is not one of the common gods or goddesses that comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Welsh mythology is not one that is typically, turned over time and again.
Yeah.
Just above that in the $800 clue. This top god had an eight-legged horse named Sleipnir. Tony got that. That's Odin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have never been able to effectively picture an eight-legged horse in my head.
Yeah.
It's just very... It's upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
I try to, and I'm like, no. No, this isn't right. Yeah,
I think that I had just sort of, like, taken the description without thinking too much on it, and now I am uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Alphabetically first. Ooh, it's tricky.
It was tricky.
Yeah.
Because when you choose a group that won't start you at, like, A or B,
yeah,
it's harder to be confident.
Mm-hmm. The $1,200 level, of course, I found straightforward. It was of the New Testament's four gospel writers. Daniel got that one. It's John. But also, it's the one that has only four options, right?
Yeah. I mean, the pack of classic five flavor lifesavers. But that's just, like, I guess if you know what the flavors are, then you can get there.
Lime, orange, red.
I think that's cherry.
Yeah, it's probably, cherry was the correct response, but, like, I think I would have, is the yellow lemon? There's yellow, right?
I have
is
no idea.
Is it red, orange, yellow, green? Are there two reds? Pineapple. Is there, like, a whitish that's pineapple?
Pineapple one of them?
I think pineapple's one of them. Mm. I don't. All right. When I edit the podcast, I sometimes leave the clicky clacky typewriter sound, like, I feel like it works as a sound effect.
Good Foley.
Yeah. Pineapple, lime, orange, cherry, and lemon.
You got it.
I did. Nice. Except that I said red for cherry because I had the answer in front of me because I knew Daniel answered cherry and that was correct. But, like, if I'd been standing on the stage, I think that I would have been like, is it cherry? Is it strawberry? Is it raspberry? It's not raspberry. I wouldn't know if it was raspberry.
Yeah. But, I mean, come on. Yeah. Who would know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's cool. You did get all of them.
Yeah. Pineapple is the surprise one there, I think.
Yes. I agree. All right, Daily Double number two is in the Gods and Myths category at the $1,600 level. It's pick number 19, and Madeline finds it. She's at 7,000. Tony's at 8,800. Daniel's at 4,000. She weighs her 2,000. Gets the clue. Pursued by Apollo, the nymph Daphne was transformed into this tree associated with poets. And she guesses what is a linden tree, but that's a laurel tree.
Mm-hmm. Right letter, wrong tree.
Mm-hmm.
And Daily Double number three is at the $1,600 level of alphabetically first. Daniel finds it just two clues later, pick number 21. He's at 5,200 with Tony at 8,800 and Madeline at 5,000. He wagers 2,000 and gets the clue of current justices of the Supreme Court by last name. He tries who is Kavanaugh, but Samuel Alito. Alito.
Yeah. I wonder if he thought Kavanaugh started with a C.
Yeah, because...
Although, Thomas Sotomayor...
Amy Coney Barrett.
Yeah, I guess Coney Barrett would be...
Is it Barrett or is it Coney? In any case...
Either way, it's earlier.
Before Kavanaugh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brown Jackson.
Yeah. Kagan also is before Kavanaugh.
Kagan is before Kavanaugh. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if he might not know very many of the names.
Yeah.
Or thought it was just the C.
Yeah.
So at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, it's a fairly close game. Tony's at 8,000, Daniel's at 8,800, Madeline's at 3,800. And the final Jeopardy category is English literature. And the clues, it says, the mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. What matter where, if I still be the same? Madeline wrote, what is Canterbury Tales? And that is incorrect. Wagered $37.99, so she drops to a dollar. Tony wrote, what is Ode to the Portuguese? That's also incorrect. Wagered $1,000, so she drops to $7,000. And Daniel got it correct with, what is Paradise Lost? And wagered $72.01, which is a cover bet, so he lands at $16,001.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was like, Ode to the Portuguese? What is that? Probably Tony was thinking of Sonnets from the Portuguese by Elizabeth mm-hmm. Barrett Browning, mm-hmm. which I don't know Elizabeth Barrett Browning that well, but like, seems like a reasonable guess given this line. Like,
sure, yeah.
I thought it was tricky. I didn't think of Paradise Lost for whatever reason. I don't know. There's an obscure work. It's not that obscure, but like not the most well-known work by Blake called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And I thought about that. And then I was like, they wouldn't have the words heaven and hell right in the clue if that's what they were thinking of. But that sort of sidetracked me. And I did not think of Paradise Lost.
I didn't either.
Yeah. Anyway, that brings us to Tuesday. Our contestants are Jeremy Felton, a chemist from Cary, North Carolina, Deb Bilodeau, a winemaker from Oakland, California, and Daniel Shiraki, a writer from Baltimore, Maryland, whose one-day cash winnings total $16,001. And the Jeopardy! Round categories are Secrets of the Elephants, a new series premiering for Earth Day, Ken says, from National Geographic. Let's guess your weight. Like, wait, don't tell me. like mm-hmm. W-A-I-T. Horoscopes, blank and blank. Okay, millennial. U.S. and Canadian postal abbreviations. Abreves.
Yeah, U.S. plus. So, like, they're looking for a word
that is right, made up yes. of two postal abbreviations. Yes, I'd forgotten that, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, like, the $200 level is Massachusetts and Saskatchewan, and that's MASK, because it's M-A-S-K.
Mm-hmm.
Or Iowa and Manitoba, which is I-M.
Mm-hmm.
I-A-M-B.
Yeah,
like that one.
That's a fun one.
That okay millennial category felt aggressive. I don't know. I didn't care for it.
Okay.
I don't know why. It was like, hey, do you remember all this stuff that was now a while ago?
Yeah. I didn't remember much of it, truth be told.
Yeah. I didn't get these from like the date.
Were they trying to make the point that millennials are not the youth anymore?
Maybe.
Because, like, that would be an interesting point to make to their, you know...
Old.
Their big, the bulk of their viewership
yeah.
is older. And...
To be like, yeah. To be like, hey, we're not kids anymore.
Yeah.
We're not even young anymore, really.
Yeah. That, like, shaking their heads about the millennials, I'm like, those are not millennials, friend.
Yeah.
Like, the older millennials are starting to like have like knee problems and like
yeah
cancer and stuff.
Right. Some of us are just as concerned about our retirement as you are, I think.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yeah. Generation Z is the generation below millennials. And the actual children, the ones who are like Kyle's kids and my kids, those are not Gen Z. We're calling those Generation Alpha right now. That'll probably change. Generation Z might change as well.
Gen A prime. Yeah.
Yeah.
We were Gen Y for a while, which is why Gen Z is Gen Z.
Right. That's right.
Anyway, Daily Double number one is in the horoscopes category at the $1,000 level. Pick number six in the round, and Deb finds it. They are at 800, Daniel's at 600, Jeremy's at 800. They wager 1,000 and get the clue. Known for passion and determination, this first sign of the zodiac bears the item sought by Jason and the Argonauts. And Deb gets it correct with what is Aries, the ram. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Daniel is at 7,600, Deb is at 3,200, Jeremy is at 3,600. And the Double Jeopardy categories are savoir-faire, their first published novel, Old War, The Otto Club, O-T-T-O, TV Moms, and Definitions from The Devil's Dictionary by Ambrose Bierce. Apparently he originally called it the Cynic's Word Book.
I had not heard of it.
Yes, it was new to me as well.
It's the kind of thing you would think I would have heard of, but...
Yeah, one would think. That's okay. So it's just like a book of witticisms, I guess?
I guess.
So like...
The couched in definitions, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, the $400 clue, a small square of silk or linen, especially serviceable at funerals to conceal the lack of tears, is a handkerchief. Okay. This sandwich fixin' with a name from the French at the $1,600 level. One of the sauces which serve the French in place of a state religion. Apparently mayonnaise. It's funny. I don't really get it, I guess.
Yeah, but hey, everybody can go back into the back catalog and listen to my deep dive about Escoffier and the mother sauces.
That's right. That's yes. Right.
There we go. I plugged the back catalog, which we are contractually obligated to do.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, one of my favorite historical names was an Old War at the $1,600 level. It was a triple stumper. In 732, he defeated an invading Muslim army in the decisive Battle of Tours, earning the nickname The Hammer. That's Charles Martel. I love that name.
He's from Game of Thrones. Just kidding. No, he's not.
Oh, from the Martel family. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Hammer of the Martels. I could read right through that in a 1,000-page novel and be like, oh yeah, I'm probably supposed to remember him.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. His name is just Charles the Hammer.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah. There are worse nicknames for sure.
Uh-huh. And of course, John Green came up at the $800 level of their first published novel. I can never just let a John or Hank Green clue go by.
You can't. I can't. No, sorry. That is accurate.
Yeah. Daily Double number two is in Old War, which we were just talking about. It's at the $1,200 level. And Daniel finds it. It's pick number 12. Daniel has 10,000. Deb is at 3,600. Jeremy's at 5,600. Daniel wagers 2,500 and gets the clue. 1462's Battle of Piltown was the only major battle fought in Ireland as part of these dynastic civil wars. He can't come up with it. It's the Wars of the Roses. Mm-hmm. Have you done a deep dive on the Wars of the Roses? It's connected.
You know, I actually thought that myself. I was like, have I done that? I don't think I've done it specifically on the Wars of the Roses, but I've done like the English monarchy.
Yeah, that's where it's come up for sure. Yeah.
We have discussed like things around that multiple times.
So. Yeah.
And Daily Double number three is two picks later in the definition from the Devil's Dictionary category at the $1,200 level. Deb finds it. They're at 4,400. Daniel's at 7,500. Jeremy's at 5,600. They wager 2,500 and get the clue. From medieval times, the kind of clothing worn by a man whose tailor is a blacksmith. And Deb gets it with what is armor. I don't know. That doesn't feel particularly clever. I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Daniel's at 8,300. Deb is at 16,500. Jeremy is at 8,000. So Deb doesn't quite have a runaway. $101 more. And they would.
Mm-hmm.
The final Jeopardy category is the Oscars. And the clue is, born in 1932 and the son of a percussionist in the CBS Radio Orchestra, he's been nominated for 53 Oscars. And all of them got this one correct. It's John Williams. Jeremy wagered 8,000, doubled up to 16,000. Daniel wagered 8,202, all but 98, and doubled up to 16,502. I guess looking to get just above where Deb was. And Deb wagered 101, which is a cover bet. And so Deb gets the win.
Yeah. And it's a real shame that it was a super easy clue, because now I can't talk about John Williams for my deep dive.
Yeah. In some ways, like, it's not necessarily that it's that easy of a clue, except that there aren't that many film composers that we're really expected to know.
Right. And it doesn't necessarily say film composer, but like the clue of
the Oscars.
The son of a percussionist in the CBS radio orchestra. It's like, okay, yeah, probably we're looking for a music name.
Yeah.
And it's going to be John Williams, like, mm-hmm. 100%.
Yeah.
Anyway, on Wednesday, we get the contestants Ben Spilsbury, a sales engineer from Long Island City, New York, Devin Lohman, an architectural designer and master's student from Peachtree City, Georgia, and Deb Bilodeau, a winemaker from Oakland, California, who just won $16,601. And we have the Jeopardy round categories, people and books. Where is it, Doc? All of You, TV, I'm So Proud, and My Kid Got Into an Ivy League Museum. I'm pretty sure the Ivy League category hit all of the important ones.
All of the important
Ivy League schools. Yeah.
Schools?
Yeah, for sure.
Because
there's Brown, and then there's Penn, and then there's Dartmouth, and then there's Yale. Oh, dang it. They did say Harvard. I was trying to make a joke.
They did, yes.
They did. I missed it.
The clue they had about a Harvard museum is fine. My daughter saw David Rockefeller's personal collection of these insects, scarabs and all, at Harvard's Museum of Natural History. Deb got that one. It's beetles. I think the clue to write here is about the glass flower collection.
Sure. Yeah. I 100% agree.
Which is mentioned in Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, but I already knew about the glass flower collection at Harvard, which I actually haven't seen. I just never quite got around to it when I was there. But there is a glass flower collection. I think it's in the Natural History Museum, of like glass replicas of flowers. And I don't think I've ever heard of anything like that elsewhere. It's notable. So
yeah.
Yeah. If I were writing a clue about a Harvard museum, that's what I would head for. But, you know, David Rockefeller's personal collection of beetles, I guess, is fine too.
It is also a thing that is real.
Mm-hmm. Daily Double number one is in People in Books at the $400 level, and Deb finds it. It's pick number five. Deb is at 600, with Devin at zero and Ben at 600, and Deb makes it a true Daily Double and gets the clue. Neighbor and narrator Nick Carraway doesn't mind some loud parties in this American classic, and they get it correct. It's The Great Gatsby. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Deb has taken a lead. I forgot that they were this far ahead. 7,600, with Devin at 1,800 and Ben at 1,600. And the Double Jeopardy categories are Justinian time, a European vacation, musicology. Each response ends with O. O is in quotation marks in the category name. A box of matches, movie comedies. We predict 5 anagrams of Nostradamus. They provide an anagram of part of Nostradamus's name, and then kind of a prompt, and then you have to anagram the remaining letters to provide the rest of the anagram, which if you've lived through people like finding random lines from Nostradamus and being like, it has 16 letters, and so did I.
It makes sense.
Yes, it worked. It was satisfying, I thought.
Yes, I very much like that. It was a fresh take on anagrams.
Yeah.
I appreciated it a lot. Because usually they give you an anagram and you have to unscramble it or whatever, but giving you the same set of letters every time with a different solution, I thought was really fun.
Yeah, that was fun. Did you get the $2,000 level of musicology? Musicology?
Musicology? Yes, I did.
I'm trying to pronounce it with the O.
With the O in quotation marks. Yeah, the $2,000 level was a lively, whimsical piece that's not too long. Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky wrote one, Italienne, in quotation marks, and they played a little bit of it. That's a capriccio.
Mm-hmm.
I think in one class period in grad school, we looked at the Italian capriccio. Or the capriccio Italienne.
Yeah.
If we want to do it that way. It's a nice piece.
Yeah.
It's definitely worth a $2,000 clue. Like, that's definitely a $2,000 level.
Yeah, I think. That one felt obscure, but I wondered, you know, sort of. Was it accessible to a subject matter expert? And sounds like yes.
It was. I definitely think it is a deep pull. It's definitely not one of the pieces that you're going to go to when you're like, all right, I need to learn some composers. Tchaikovsky's a big name. You know, let's learn the top pieces. The Capriccio Italian is not going to be one of the of the main ones. I did appreciate the $1,200 level, though. Let's listen to a demonstration of this term. You can't actually reach one because it means constantly increasing. I believe I've talked about this on the podcast. That's crescendo. A lot of authors who don't know music like to use that term.
To reach a crescendo.
To mean like a climax. And it's like, that's not what that is.
That's
a crescendo. Mm-hmm. Crescendo is the rising action.
Right. Yeah.
So I appreciate that clarification. Thank you, Jeopardy writers. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We had a correctly answered Gibraltar clue, which, hey, throwback to my Gibraltar deep dive.
Yep.
The $1,200 level of a European vacation. Winston Churchill Avenue cut across the airport runway in this British territory that knows how to rock us.
Zanzibar.
Yeah. Devin got that one.
Yeah. Daily Double number 2 is in the musicology category back there. It's at the $1,600 level. It's pick number 10, so it's like right between the crescendo and the Capriccio Italian. Devin finds it. He's at 5,800. Deb is at 12,400. Ben is at 2,800. And Devin bets it all. And gets
bold move.
Bold move, but I think smart.
Smart move. Good move.
Yeah, the right move. Uh-huh. Gets a clue. Play the notes of a chord in sequence instead of together, and you've got this. He gets it correct with what is an arpeggio.
Mm-hmm. And nobody gets the next one correct. That's Capriccio at pick number 11. And so then Devin calls the next clue, calls for the $1,600 level of Justinian time. And that is where we find Daily Double number 3. Devin's at 11,600 at this point, right where we left him after Daily Double 2. And Deb is at 12,400 and Ben is at 2,800, right where we left them. Devin wagers 7,000 this time and gets, this is, again, a bold move. I don't think it's the wrong move.
No.
Yeah. We've still got 18 clues, $17,200 remaining on the board. So Devin gets the clue. Justinian didn't want to thank this 900-year-old Athenian school, which closed after pagan teachers were banned. And he gets it correct. It is the Academy. And that just rockets him way up into the lead. Yeah.
But then, over the course of the rest of the round, Deb just like climbs.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Deb is at 18,800, Devin's at 20,600, and Ben's at 4,400. Final Jeopardy category is Lives of the Poets, and the clue is, at a seminary that classified students' degree of faith, Emily Dickinson was without this, which she compares to a bird in a poem. Ben wrote, what is faith? Faith was in the clue, so unlikely that that's going to be the right response. Wagered everything but a dollar, so he dropped $1. Deb wrote, what is doubt? That is also incorrect. And Deb bet everything, which I am going to say is strategically incorrect. Because Deb ended up behind Ben with $1. You can at least avoid that. And Devin wrote, what is God? That is also incorrect, and wagered a cover bet of $19,400.
Yeah.
A little bit more than a cover bet.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, quite a bit more than a cover bet. But I don't know. A cover bet would still have put him in danger of falling under Ben. Mm-hmm. So I think it's fine. And so he dropped to $1,200 and ended up winning with $1,200. The correct answer is hope.
Hope is the thing with feathers.
The thing with feathers.
Yep. We had a little debate in my house about Ben's wager, because, you know, Deb wagered everything, which is a strategic error, and drops to zero. Devin has to make a huge cover bet and drops to 1,200. So with a zero wager, Ben could have won. So like the back and forth was like, should Ben have wagered zero and hoped for an incorrect wager, a strategically non-optimal wager and a miss, which in fact, you know, he did get, it would have paid off. But like, if your success is contingent on people making a strategically incorrect wager, like how do you guess what incorrect wager people are going to go for, right? Like that's,
there is an infinite number of possibilities.
Yes. It would have been nice for him if things had just happened to pay off. But, you know, once you're relying on people making an incorrect wager, like, you might as well just try to maximize your score, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Bet on yourself. Hope you get it right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Thursday, April 20th, the contestants are Emma Hill Kepron, a librarian from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, Sam Clausen, a history professor from Santa Clarita, California, and Devin Lohman, an architectural designer and master's student from Peachtree City, Georgia, whose one-day cash winnings total $1,200. And the Jeopardy round categories are history, literary fruit stand, flying colors, missing you. The response will include the yous that have been omitted from the clue. 80s and 90s R&B songs, and My Prerogative.
Mm-hmm. The missing you category at the $400 level. Sam really missed an opportunity. The clue is it was discovered in 1781, R-A-N-S, or Rans. And Sam pronounced it Uranus, which I guess is fine. But I think I wouldn't have been able to resist being like, Uranus, Ken.
What is Uranus? Yeah.
What is Uranus, Ken?
I would have. And in fact, I would have been so mortified at the thought of pronouncing it either way on television that I would have been. I would have been very intimidated about ringing the buzzer.
Yeah.
One of those, how much is it worth to me to say this on TV? Right. And like, it should be worth the Jeopardy win, but like, I think that I would struggle to make myself ring the buzzer.
Yeah, I get that. In the flying colors category, that was all about airlines. I knew them all mostly because of Jeopardy. Like, I have no reason to know that Aer Lingus is the airline of Ireland, except that it's always on Jeopardy whenever they have an airline category. Or that El Al at the $1,000 level is the Israeli airline.
Yeah.
I've never flown them. I have no reason to know that. And the only reason I do know that is because they've come up so much on Jeopardy that I remember them now.
Those two I happen to know because I have gone to those places and like, remember. Well, you've gone places.
I'm just kidding.
Anyway, I remember seeing like those particular logos and colors and stuff. This was a category that focused on like kind of airlines visual branding, and the ones they chose have, you know, pretty distinctive looks. Right. So I remember seeing those. But yeah, there's a lot of airline and airport trivia that comes up in Jeopardy where I'm like, I don't have any particular reason to like know a whole bunch of airport abbreviations, but it does come up a lot. Were it not for Jeopardy, I think I would know like LAX and like my local airports.
Daily Double number one is in that flying colors category. It's at the $800 level. Pick number 20, Devin finds it. He's at $2,400. Sam is at $5,600. Emma is at $3,800. He bets it all and gets the clue. This airline's planes sport purple, fuchsia, and coral to depict Pualani, the flower of the sky, who wears a hibiscus in her hair. And Devin guesses what is Polynesian Air, but that is Hawaiian Airlines. The hibiscus is the state flower of Hawaii.
Yes.
So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Devin has had a rough go of it. He is at negative 1,000. Sam is at 6,400. Emma is at 6,600. And the double Jeopardy categories are Face the Politician, Globe Trotting, Reptiles, Potpourri with P in quotation marks, Triple Homophones, and Remembering Barbara Walters. I really like that Triple Homophones category.
Yeah, that was really fun.
Yes. And they did pretty well with it.
Yeah. And they played them a little bit out of order. They started from the 800, worked down to the 2000, and then came back up to the 400. But yeah, Duo, Cut the Excess, A Red Anjou, that is Pair, P-A-I-R, P-A-R-E, P-E-A-R, Pair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these were fun.
Yep. That $2,000 clue I thought was appropriately difficult. A litter of pigs, an ancient grain, an ancient ruler. That's Pharaoh. Which, of course, when they said it, I was like, oh yeah, I do know those words. But trying to get there was going to be tough.
Yeah. There's also, there's a card game called Pharaoh, which I think is usually spelled F-A-R-O.
Yes, there is, isn't there?
Yeah. I don't think I knew that a litter of pigs was a pharaoh. I didn't know Pharaoh the Grain. I like that one.
Yeah.
I think they sell it at Trader Joe's.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
They got all the politicians. Good for them.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Daily Double number 2 comes up super early. Pick number 2 in Globetrotting at the $1,600 level. Devin finds it. Devin is just at 200 with Sam at 6,400 and Emma at 6,600. He wagers 2,000 and gets the clue. This second holiest Muslim city contains the tomb of Muhammad. And he gets it correct. It is Medina.
Yep. And 2 clues later, he comes across Daily Double number 3 in the reptiles category at the $1,600 level. And the scores are pretty much the same.
He picked up the 2,000 in between.
Right. So he's making a move now. He's up to 4,200. And Sam and Emma are the same. And he wagers 3,200 of that 4,200. He gets the clue. Akin of alligators and crocodiles, this Central and South American reptile lends its name to an island group near Jamaica. And he gets it correct with, what is a caiman?
Mm-hmm. The amount of money that Devin has picked up on Daily Doubles in these last couple of games is...
a lot.
Impressive. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Sam and Emma play well. And by the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Devin's at 10,200. Sam's at 18,400. Emma is at 15,400. I think maybe Devin just really struggled with the buzzer, right? Let me find the buzzer stats. Yeah. Devin is 22.81% in first on the buzzer. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening. I don't know if he's trying for it. I haven't pulled up the box score, but yeah, he clearly knows his stuff because he keeps getting these daily doubles. But yeah, the buzzer and Devin are not doing so well. But Devin's at 10,200. Sam's at 18,400. Emma's at 15,400. The final Jeopardy category is modern words. And the clue is Neal Stephenson coined this word in his 1992 novel Snow Crash. It was later shortened by a company to become its new name. And people go for the wrong part of the clue here, yeah. I think the contestants don't know what they're looking for, and they focus in on Snow Crash and try and come up with something that will fit there. So Devin tries, what is powder? He's wagered 8,300. That drops him down to 1,900. Emma tries, what is Uber? Emma's not focusing on Snow Crash. Emma is focusing on a new company name. That's not correct either. $4,000 wager drops her down to 11,400. And Sam tries, what is avalanche? And with a cover bet of 12,401, drops down to 5,999. Metaverse is what we were looking for here.
Yeah.
So I got to it by thinking about a like high profile company rename.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to go for it.
Did you figure this one out, Kyle?
No, didn't get anywhere close. I mean, since 1992, that's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It was later shortened by a company to become its new name. Like, that could have been a lot of companies. I did not get to Meta
at all. Yeah. So Emma finishes with 11,400 and the win.
That's right. And that brings us to Friday, when we have the contestants Igor Petrovich, an attorney from Ashburn, Virginia, Anjali Salvador, a lawyer from Houston, Texas, and Emma Hill-Kepron, a librarian from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, whose one-day cash winnings total $11,400. And we have the Jeopardy! Round categories, Basketball Greats, The California Missions, Sliding Into Your DMs, with DM in quotation marks and abbreviations, Rhyme Time, You Drive, and A Hard Bargain.
Mm-hmm. We had a tough triple stumper at the $600 level of Sliding Into Your DMs. First name Klaus, the namesake of this boot brand, was a physician in the German army. Igor tried, who is Doc Martin? And Emma tried, who is Dr. Martin? It turns out that it's not Martin apostrophe S. It's Martin with an S. Doc Martens is his name. They were asking for the boot brand, which is, well, I would not have been confident about whether there was an S in it or whether people just sort of added the S.
Yeah, that's always colloquially hard to say.
Yeah,
because people love adding S's on the ends of things.
Yeah,
especially when they're brand names.
Yes, or the last book of the Bible, Revelation.
Yeah,
Yeah. Jeopardy will ding you for revelation versus revelations. Probably yes. Listeners of the podcast already know that, but.
Mm-hmm. It was but one revelation.
They really did not like the California missions category.
Yeah. Four triple stumpers.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, none of them are from anywhere close to California, at least where they're living now. So I don't necessarily blame them, because if you don't necessarily speak Spanish or if you don't have any California experience, these are things that are just kind of wild guesses,
I would say. Yeah. And then even, I mean, Jeopardy will usually throw a general knowledge question or two into the mix in each category where the content of the clue is related, but the correct response is kind of, orthogonal. It's a separate thing. But that one just didn't work out for them either. The $1,000 level, Native Americans who converted to Christianity at the missions were called these, from Greek for newly planted. I don't know whether being an expert in California missions would make you know the word neophytes, maybe, but it mostly seemed like they found a cool vocabulary word, gave the etymology for it, and then drew a connection to the topic. But that one just happened to not hit either for any of these contestants.
Yeah. And if they have Spanish knowledge, then you could guess at the $400 clue. Founded in 1791, the mission in this Central Coast UC city is the only one named not for a saint, but for the cross that Santa Cruz, which if you know that Cruz is cross.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So Spanish knowledge could help there. Spanish knowledge would help with Camino Real.
Yeah. For Royal Road, because that's what that means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But just rough category here for them. Yeah. Daily double number one is in sliding into your DMs at the $400 level. Anjali finds it at pick number six. She has 1800 with Emma at 200 and Igor at zero. She makes it a true daily double. Nice move. And gets the clue. The dome on the Capitol building of this Midwest city is gilded with 23 karat gold leaf. I got a little stuck until I remembered the category. Anjali had it right away. It's Des Moines.
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't remember the category, you're
which Midwest city are they showing me a picture of? What am I supposed to know about its dome and its gold leaf?
why would 23 carat mean anything to me for a particular city in the Midwest? Yeah.
Yep. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Emma's at 600, Anjali's at 4,600, Igor's gotten up to 4,800, so a small lead. And the double Jeopardy categories are Speak of the Dickens, Go Jump in a Lake, Scientific Numbers, Foreign Political Parties, five-letter words with F in quotation marks, and cutting in line at the movies. They will provide a cutting remark, and you provide the movie.
As we suggest to anybody who's going to be on the show, listen to the entirety of our episode list. It's only 160-something.
Yep.
That's only half a month, I guess, of time.
If you just listen night and day, right? No, yeah, maybe not.
Literally nonstop.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. 160. Yeah. And they're over an hour each.
Oh, maybe not half a month, but it's close. A while. It's close. Over a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they could have gotten the Dickens category.
They could have. I don't remember if I mentioned Wilkie Collins in the Dickens deep dive. That name did not return to me. But Emma knew Wilkie Collins, the friend with whom Dickens collaborated on several stories and author of The Moonstone. Wilkie Collins. I don't remember if I mentioned Wilkie Collins, but I was impressed with Emma for getting him. And yes, we covered quite a bit of this when I did the Dickens novels deep dive.
Yes. Yes, we did.
Yeah.
There was, I thought, some real neg bait at the $2,000 level of five-letter words that didn't end up getting done. Anjali got it correct. But the clue was, Pachelbel composed this type of composition in D minor and also in F major. And if you're not remembering the category that it has to be a five-letter word that starts with F, then your Pavlov for Pachelbel would probably be canon.
Canon, yeah.
Which is a five-letter word.
Mm-hmm, but doesn't start with F.
Doesn't start with F. And his canon is in D major, not D minor. Mm-hmm. Anjali got it, though. That's a fugue.
Yes. Igor forgot the category at the $400 level of five-letter words. And my seven-year-old got a rebound from the couch. Food groups often left off nutritional guidelines include nougat, meringue, and this sweet stuff seen with bread. And Igor tried marshmallow, and then Emma got the rebound for real. But my seven-year-old shouted it out from the couch first. The fluff. Fluff is the five-letter word. Marshmallow fluff, specifically. Fluff. But fluff is the one. Is fluff national?
We have it. We have a jar in our pantry, but I think it is more regional, at least in terms of preference. I did not encounter it except for my wife's family, who are all from the East Coast.
Yeah. The Fluffernutter has been proposed as the official state sandwich of Massachusetts. Okay, so there is some...
I mean, it's delicious, but like, I guess it's a sandwich by definition. I really just...
In what way is it not a sandwich?
It is a sandwich. It meets all the requirements. There's no real functional difference between that and a peanut butter and jelly. I just... I approach
like nutritionally,
I don't know. I approach it as like a dessert thing. I do not approach a Fluffernutter as like, this is the main course of a meal, or like, this is what I'm going to have for lunch.
Are you, wait, okay. So it is functionally no different from a peanut butter and jelly, and it's not appropriate as a meal. Are you claiming here on this podcast that a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is not an appropriate lunch food?
It is, which I realize I'm working out loud this idiosyncrasy in my brain. I get it. I understand what you're saying. I get what you're saying, but just without having thought about it, I do not approach a Fluffernutter in the same way that I approach, I would call, a typical sandwich.
Okay. I guess I get that. I guess.
Listen, I have some work to do with this.
Okay, yeah.
I have some emotional and mental processing.
Go reflect on this.
Yes. I will sleep. I will reboot. And when I wake up tomorrow, my system will have updated and it will be consolidated.
Okay, cool. I'll look forward to an update on this.
Sorry to have caused such distress for you, Emily.
It's okay.
Dare you malign the Fluffernutter?
Not on this podcast. No, sir.
Daily Double number 2 was also in the five-letter words category. It's at the $1,600 level, and Emma finds it at pick number 8. She is at $2,200. Anjali is at $6,600. Igor is at $5,200. And she wagers $1,500, which is less than the value of the clue.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she just doesn't like five-letter words. I don't know. Gets the clue. In its simplest form, it's a sheet of paper folded in half to make 2 leaves or 4 pages. Shakespeare's had a lot more. And she gets it correct with what is a folio.
Mm-hmm. And Daily Double number 3 is in foreign political parties. At the $1,600 level, Igor finds this one at pick number 12. He's at $6,800, behind Anjali at $8,600, Emma's at $3,700. He wagers $2,000. If he's correct, he'll take a slim lead. And he gets the clue, banned from 1960 to 1990 by the South African government. This party led the fight to destroy apartheid. We touched on this last week. The ANC, African National Congress, is the correct response here, and he gets it.
Yeah. So going into Final Jeopardy. Emma is at 12,100. Igor is at 12,000. And Anjali is at 9,400. Very close. At the Final Jeopardy category, historic groups. And the clue is, originally a term for security escorts for commanders, in 27 BC, this group was designated an official imperial force. Anjali got it correct with what is the Praetorian Guard. And wagered 2,500, which put her up to 11,900. And I'm not sure about that. I wonder if the math was she ended up 100 below 12,000 instead of 100 above 12,000. I don't know.
Yeah. Let's see. If she misses, she'll drop down to 6,900.
Nice.
Just walked right into that. I'm not sure I see what's significant about that either. I do see the value in keeping the wager small on the assumption that Emma's going to make a cover bet trying to cover Igor, and Igor is going to probably try and cover a double up from Anjali. So I think it's reasonable to assume that we're going to see pretty large wagers, and that from third place, maybe your best move is to keep it fairly small and hope they drop below you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see that
the exact number, because if you're gonna get that close,
I don't see any reason that 6,800 would be worse,
right?
Specifically,
I would think if you're gonna get that close, I would say just like bet a little bit more.
Yep, another 100
against a zero.
Yeah.
So yeah, she gets correct and moves up. Igor wrote, "What are centurions?" Or put an extra A in there, and it became centaurians, which is just. Awesome.
Trying to picture Roman centaurians. Yes.
Although I think my understanding of centaurs is they don't like to wear armor, but whatever. And he wagered 11,000, which covers an Anjali double up, but he drops to 1,000. And Emma got it correct with what is the Praetorian Guard, and only wagered 2,500.
Yeah.
Which I thought was bizarre. If it was wrong, it would have kept her above Anjali's zero, but Anjali probably wasn't going to bet zero, and Igor probably also wasn't going to bet zero.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the thinking is here.
I mean, perhaps the thinking is a cover bet is basically everything.
Yeah.
And so am I going to bet that I'm going to get it right, or am I going to bet that we're going to get it wrong? Our stance is you should bet on yourself getting it right.
Yep.
That's yep. more likely. But
yeah, I mean, I could see a bet to assume that Igor is going to cover Anjali's double up and no more, and mm-hmm. to not make a full cover bet, but take that guess, which would be an incorrect guess in this case. But yeah, I'm not really sure why 2,500 here.
Either way,
it works out.
Yeah, Emma gets the win. Coming back Monday. Mm-hmm. So that's the end of the week. And this is the point where we remind you that we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/potentpotables. We put some stuff up there. Sometimes it's quiz questions. And you can go there to support us financially if you so desire. We very much appreciate our patrons thus far who have made it possible for us to not lose money on things like hosting fees, editing technology, that kind of thing. So if you feel the desire to do that, you can slide us a few bucks a month at patreon.com/potentpotables. And there are some more important things in the world. We have some causes in the show notes that we believe in and encourage you to check out if you also have money to contribute to those causes. Especially one that I'm going to point out just because of the week that it is the Rebels Project. It was begun by a handful of people, one of which is my colleague, one of the fellow teachers at my school who is a Columbine survivor, and they do work with communities who fall victim to mass shootings, and mm-hmm. they do very good work, and it is very important. And of course, this last week was the anniversary of Columbine, which mm-hmm. hits our community pretty hard every year. So if you're feeling like you've got mm-hmm. something to contribute, I strongly encourage you to check out the Rebels Project.
Yeah. Yeah, it's important stuff.
Yeah. So on that note, Emily, let's lighten it up and tell us what we're going to talk about.
Okay. Well, we had a couple of missed final Jeopardies. They were about the metaverse and Emily Dickinson, and I'm not sure either of those really have your name on them. So I'm going to skip right past those on my list. Are we talking about Janissaries?
We are not. I thought about it.
Okay, what about Charles the Hammer Martell?
That was my second choice.
Okay. I think we mentioned that we have touched on, tangentially, the Wars of the Roses, but we have not had a deep dive on the Wars of the Roses. So that'll be my third guess.
That was also on my short list. Okay. But I felt that, like, well, I've done a lot of English history.
Yeah, that's kind of why I put it on the list.
And, like, while it appeals to me because I find that stuff interesting, I was like, we should vary it out. And I realize this is not my wheelhouse, but that's why kind of why I chose it. So I picked Emily Dickinson.
What?
I know.
I'm so excited.
I was like, I tell my students that you practice the things you're bad at, not the mm-hmm. things you're good at. So mm-hmm. I should practice the things I'm bad at. So
this is thrilling. I'm going to mark it on my calendar.
So yeah, the Wednesday Final Jeopardy was missed. The clue was at a seminary that classified students' degree of faith, Emily Dickinson was without this, which she compares to a bird in a poem, and that is Hope, from one of her better-known poems. So I'm going to talk about Emily Dickinson. I'm going to talk a little bit about her life. I'm going to skip over some stuff, like she died at the age of 55. We could have 55 years worth of details. I'll try to narrow it down to some of the more relevant stuff and more memorable, and then talk a little bit about her poetry. So here we go. Emily Elizabeth Dickinson was born on December 10th, 1830, There is not a whole lot, well, we have a lot known now from writings that were kind of discovered after her death. Also, she had a lot of letter communications between people by the end of her life. In fact, that was basically the only way that she communicated with people was through writing. And her family and community, you know, kept track of her. And so we have details about her life, but she herself was rather reclusive through most of her adulthood. She is an American poet and is considered one of the most important figures in American poetry. She was born in Amherst, Massachusetts, and studied at Amherst Academy for 7 years in her youth, and also attended Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, which is where the clue comes from. And she spent much of her life in isolation, but was a prolific writer. Although, like I said, it wasn't until after her death that most of her writings were discovered. Her family was prominent, but not wealthy. Her father, Edward, was a lawyer and a trustee of Amherst College. And Emily Dickinson's grandfather, Samuel, was one of the founders of Amherst College, and in 1813 he built the Homestead, which was a large mansion on the town's main street, and that was where the Dickinson family lived for almost a century. Emily had a brother named William Austin, who was also called Austin or Aust or Aw, and she had a younger sister named Lavinia. They also had a distant cousin named Baxter Dickinson, and his family, including his grandson, the organist and composer Clarence Dickinson, which Clarence Dickinson is not a particularly well-known composer, but he did set some of Emily's poems to music fairly early on. She was a well-behaved girl. She was contented and not much trouble, which, you know, for whatever that means. She had an affinity for piano and music. In 1840, she and her sister Lavinia, like I said, started together at Amherst Academy. It was a former boys' school, and it was open to female students just a couple years earlier. During that time, Dickinson's family moved into a large new home that they called the Mansion, and the house overlooked Amherst's burial ground, described by one local minister as treeless and forbidding, which I think contributes perhaps to Dickinson's whole deal.
Yeah.
As we'll find out later. She spent 7 years at the Academy, studied English, classic literature, Latin, botany, and various other things. Botany in particular became important to her. She was almost better known as a gardener by the like neighbors and community during her life than as a poet. She was a very bright student and an excellent scholar, and she enjoyed her studies, although some years she had to take long periods off due to illness. She was troubled from a young age by the deepening menace of death, especially the death of those close to her. A close friend and second cousin, Sophia Holland, died of typhus in 1844, which traumatized Dickinson, and she kind of carried that with her for a while. At Amherst, she made some friends, such as Abiah Root, Abby Wood, Jane Humphrey, and Susan Huntington Gilbert. Susan Gilbert is important in Emily Dickinson's life. Later on, Susan would marry Dickinson's brother, Austin, and they had a close relationship throughout their life. In 1845, a religious revival took place in Amherst, and many of Dickinson's peers had conversion experiences, confessions of faith. She also wrote that she never enjoyed such perfect peace and happiness as the short time in which I felt I had found my savior. So during that time, that kind of led to her like moving over to seminary, and she had some real religious feelings. Those did not necessarily remain so strong throughout her life.
Mm.
When she was 18, her family befriended a young attorney named Benjamin Franklin Newton, and she became close to him as well. Their relationship was probably not romantic, but Newton was one of a handful of older men who kind of like inspired her or mentored her, or she would refer to them variously as tutors, preceptors, or masters in different writings. Newton likely introduced her to the writings of William Wordsworth, and he gave her Ralph Waldo Emerson's first book of collected poems. And that had an impact on her. She referred to her father's law student as having taught her and touched the secret spring. During the 1850s, Emily developed a strong and affectionate relationship, like I said, with her sister-in-law, Susan Gilbert. Dickinson eventually sent her over 300 letters, more than anyone else, over the course of their relationship. Susan was very supportive of her, playing the role of most beloved friend, influence, muse, and advisor. In an 1882 letter to Susan, Dickinson wrote, "With the exception of Shakespeare, you have told me more knowledge of anyone living." Historically, this relationship was kind of like glossed over. However, it is possible, and maybe perhaps even likely, that Susan and Emily had a romantic relationship. One letter from 1852 proclaims, "Susie, will you indeed come home next Saturday and be my own again and kiss me? I hope for you so much and feel so eager for you, feel that I cannot wait, feel that I now must have you, that the expectation once more to see your face again makes me feel hot and feverish, and my heart beats so fast. My darling, so near I seem to you, that I disdain this pen and wait for a warmer language." I think that's pretty clear. I know that, like, she's a poet, so, like, I guess things can be interpreted, but, like, I don't know. Seems pretty obvious that they were good friends, you know, roommates or whatever.
They were roommates.
They were roommates. yeah. So seems likely. There's no like actual confirmation, I guess, but seems likely. Yeah. And this is probably overlooked because of Mabel Loomis Todd. So Austin Dickinson was married to Susan Gilbert, and Susan kind of had this relationship with Emily. Austin, later in their marriage, fell in love with Mabel Loomis Todd, mm-hmm. and so had an affair with her. And after Emily's death and Susan's death, Mabel Todd and Austin and Lavinia kind of took charge of getting Emily's work published and like building up her name and like getting her stuff out there. But Mabel Todd had this jealousy towards Susan, of course, being Austin's wife. And so a lot of what we would have known about Susan was kind of like obscured by Mabel Todd. Yeah, as you could probably guess, the marriage between Austin and Susan, which started in 1856, was not a happy one, mm-hmm. naturally, since both of them seemed to seek solace in other people. So by the 1850s, Emily Dickinson began withdrawing more and more from the outside world and had started writing poetry from an early age. She continued to do that in her isolation and didn't really share these with anyone. In 1858 to 1865, she created 40 fascicles that had nearly 800 poems, and those were not known until after her death.
Wow.
In the 1850s, she also befriended Samuel Bowles, who owned and edited the Springfield Republican. They developed a friendship, and she sent him nearly 50 poems. Some of them were published in the Republican. So, you know, some people read her poetry, but she didn't gain a lot of fame as a poet. The first half of the 1860s, she had pretty much withdrawn from social life, and that was when she had her most productive writing period. It's possible she had agoraphobia, right?
Mm-hmm.
She also may have suffered from epilepsy. She was diagnosed with having nervous prostration, which may have been that. Yeah, so I mentioned before, Newton was one of the men who kind of like played a role in her artistic development. Samuel Bowles was another one who she referred to as master in some writings. And then in 1862, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, a literary critic, wrote a piece for the Atlantic Monthly giving young people advice on how to break into print. And so she wrote a few poems addressed to him in that way, originally referring to him as Mr. Higginson, then dear friend, as well as signing her letters to him as your gnome or your scholar. So Higginson had a positive impact on her too. And Dickinson later told him that he had saved her life in 1862. Toward the end of her life, she continued to live at home and hardly leave her home for any reason. But she did remain socially active, I guess, through her notes and letters. And like I mentioned, she was known during her lifetime probably more widely as a gardener than a poet. I had mentioned that she'd studied botany, and along with her sister, they tended the garden at Homestead. She assembled a collection of pressed plants in a 66-page leather-bound herbarium containing 424 pressed flower specimens that she had collected, classified, and labeled. She had a well-tended garden and, I guess, not greenhouse, but like flower collection. In 1874, her father, Edward Dickinson, suffered a stroke and died. The simple funeral was at the Homestead's entrance hall, and Dickinson stayed in her room with the door cracked open. She did not attend the memorial service either. She loved her father. She said his heart was pure and terrible, and I think no other like it exists. A year later, Dickinson's mother also suffered a stroke, which led to partial lateral paralysis. She was not as close with her mother as she was with her father. Her mother was kind of cold and aloof, but it still affected her. She had a late life relationship with Otis Phillips Lord, who was a judge on the Massachusetts Supreme Court. It's possible that it was romantic, but all of their letters were destroyed, so we're not sure of that. They had shared interests in Shakespeare's works and poetry and like literature and that kind of thing. Judge Lord died in March of 1884, which also affected her. In the later years of her life, Dickinson stopped editing and organizing her poems, and she got a promise from her sister Lavinia to burn all of her papers after she died. Lavinia remained at the homestead until her own death in 1899. I mentioned the relationship with Mabel Loomis Todd and between Austin and Todd. Throughout the 1880s, these deaths of close friends and family piled up on Emily Dickinson. And on May 15th, 1886, she died at the age of 55. The chief physician gave the cause of death as Bright's disease, which is a kidney disease now referred to as acute or chronic nephritis. Susan Gilbert washed Dickinson's body and prepared her for a funeral, and also wrote her obituary, ending it with the four lines from one of Dickinson's poems. Morns like these we parted, noons like these she rose, fluttering first, then firmer to her fair repose. So, like I said, most of her poems were not published during her lifetime. Lavinia had promised to destroy all of Emily's letters after her death, which she pretty much did. However, as they were going through Emily's stuff after her death, Lavinia and Austin discovered these fascicles and these collections of hundreds and hundreds of poems. And the promise that she had made did not include those books, and so she didn't feel bad about bringing them out and getting them published. She turned first to Susan, Austin's wife, and then to Mabel Loomis Todd for assistance. And so the manuscripts ended up being divided between the Todd and Dickinson houses due to a feud, which meant that a complete publication of Dickinson's poetry wouldn't happen for more than half a century. Nearly a dozen new editions of her poetry were published between 1914 and 1945, either by the Dickinson line or the Todd line. And the first scholarly publication came in 1955 with a complete new three-volume set edited by Thomas H. Johnson. Yeah. So that's the publication. There are so many poems, I'm not going to try to list any of them. However, if we look at kind of three periods of her writing career, pre-1861, in the period before 1858, the poems are most often conventional and sentimental in nature. They have some mock Valentines, they have humorous or just kind of conventional lyrics. In 1861 to 1865, this was her most creative period, and these represent her most vigorous and creative work. She churned out, obviously, a large number and also a bit more depth concerning nature, life, and mortality. And then the last third, after 1866, her production slowed considerably, and she no longer collected these poems in fascicles. Her poetry is known for being very concise, you know, short lines, short poems themselves, use of dashes and unconventional capitalization, idiosyncratic vocabulary and imagery. She avoided pentameter, opting more often for trimeter, tetrameter, or sometimes even dimeter. And she most often employed the ballad stanza, a traditional form that is divided into quatrains. Different poems have different meters. She wasn't just stuck to one type. And like we've kind of gotten at the major themes in her poetry, she was, you know, influenced by transcendentalism and by the deaths that occurred in her life and by her interests, of course. She has a lot of imagery of flowers and gardens. Of course, we know she was a botanist. She refers to a number of people in poems as masters, which we consider referring to the various men who played, like, you know, mentor roles in her life. Morbidity, of course, we know, we often associate Emily Dickinson poems with, like, death. Something to do with death. Dying, illness, death, lots of death in there. She has some gospel poems. Her Christian tradition was, you know, important to her. And then there's a reference to the undiscovered continent, which was kind of this sort of spiritual view that Dickinson had of the mind and spirit as a tangible, visitable place, and that for much of her life she lived within them. So any, like, references to castles or prisons or islands or, you know, the undiscovered continent, those are kind of her take on this metaphysical idea of the mind and the spirit. So that's most of the information. Like, you know, obviously we know Emily Dickinson is one of the most important American poets, taught all over the place. Her herbarium is held at the Houghton Library at Harvard. Yeah, and was published in 2006 as Emily Dickinson's Herbarium by Harvard University Press. And lots of, you know, modern influence, of course. Recently, a 2018 romantic comedy called Wild Nights with Emily was made and is kind of based on her relationship with Susan Gilbert. The Dickinson TV series on Apple TV, starring Hailee Steinfeld, premiered in 2019. There's a public garden in Paris named Square Emily Dickinson in the 20th arrondissement, as well as a number of other things. So there we go. That's Emily Dickinson. I skipped over, you know, a bunch of details, but those are kind of the big points to remember.
Cool. Yeah, she's such a cool figure.
Yeah, she is somebody who like entered the family, referred to her like as simply the myth, which is a pretty cool thing. This is a week for cool nicknames. All right. Are you ready for a quiz, Emily?
I sure am. There is recess outside my window, so apologies for any background noise.
Yeah.
Sorry, fine. Listeners.
Hey, you know what? There's more energy that way.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. I decided to, for each of these, to take a poem of Emily Dickinson's and base it off the poem, but like use it as the launching point. So the first one is based on the poem Hope is the Thing with Feathers. I'm also going to read each poem because they're short, and I figure if we hear some of these poems, then we'll be able to recognize them. So the first one I chose was Hope is the Thing with Feathers. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. So based on the idea of hope is the thing with feathers, on September 10th, 1945, a farmer from Fruta, Colorado named Lloyd Olson attempted to kill Mike. Mike survived the attack, and the two ended up traveling the country as an unlikely duo. Mike choked to death 18 months later after the inciting incident, but not before capturing the nation's imagination. What was Miracle Mike?
All right. Presumably Mike is a thing with feathers, or else maybe tried to kill something with feathers, but I don't think that you'd go that direction. It's a meta-analysis on the quiz questions. You know, I initially assumed that the farmer tried to kill Miracle Mike because Mike was some kind of predator, and I was thinking like an eagle, a vulture, but maybe he was a chicken or a, you know, a domestic fowl of some kind. I'm gonna go with the chicken.
That's a good choice. Miracle Mike was the headless chicken that toured the country and survived without a head.
That's funny.
Yes. So, yeah, Lloyd Olson's mother-in-law was over. He went out to get the fattest chicken to make some fried chicken for everyone. And then Mike didn't die. Who knows if it was called Mike before the incident or after, but came known as Miracle Mike and then choked to death on a thing like a kernel of corn or something.
How does a headless chicken choke to death?
Well,
I guess, you know what?
It was fed with an eyedropper and like a mixture of like milk and meal and like little pieces of corn you could just like drop right in there. But something got stuck and they couldn't find the tool they used to unstick it. So
gross. Okay. Yeah. I did ask.
You did ask. So there you go. All right. You got it. 10 points. He was indeed a chicken. All right. The next poem is Because I Could Not Stop for Death. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had to put away my labor and my leisure too for his civility. We passed the school where children strove at recess in the ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain, we passed the setting sun. Or rather, he passed us. The dews drew quivering and chill. For only gossamer, my gown, my tippet, only tulle. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice in the ground. Since then, 'tis centuries, and yet feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. So question two is, fans of Dogma and the Smurfs know what name for the Abrahamic angel of death?
I haven't seen a lot of Smurfs, but I have seen Dogma, but it's been a while. Azrael? Azrael is coming to mind.
And Azrael is correct. Azrael is also the name of Gargamel's cat.
I remembered there was a Smurfs connection there with Azrael. It popped into my head and I was like, I'm pretty sure that I associate that with the Smurfs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also appears in some of the more modern Batman stories. Well, not the actual Angel of Death, just a person who calls themselves Azrael. So the name comes up a lot in pop culture. Cool. You got it. All right. 20 points. Question three, the next poem is, I'm nobody, who are you? I'm nobody, who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us, don't tell, they'd advertise, you'd know. How dreary to be somebody, how public, like a frog, to tell one's name, the lifelong June, to an admiring bog. So, question three is, in a particular video game, nobodies are the result of a strong-willed person losing their heart to the darkness. I guess that means that weak-willed people just become heartless. Despite acquiring Marvel and Star Wars later, Disney has not built a theme park for what video game series? And I'm pretty sure I've asked about this game before.
Oh, no. You may very well have, but I'm not sure I know it. Despite acquiring Marvel and Star Wars later, makes me think that there is a Marvel and or Star Wars connection with the video game. Mm. I'm trying to think of even like a video game that I don't know anything about that could be a reasonable guess. It's really hard to think of a video game you don't know anything about.
It's hard to think of a lot of things you don't know anything about.
Right? Like, sometimes I'm like, this would be a good strategy, right? Like, I'll just come up with something that I know is a thing, but I don't know anything about it. And then I can only think of things that I am familiar with. Mm-hmm. You know, a while back, I took a wild guess on some, maybe a movie question, and said The Eternals. And you were like, no, that's a Marvel thing. So I'm going to guess The Eternals.
It is not The Eternals. It is Kingdom Hearts.
Oh no, I have heard of that.
Yeah, they haven't built anything with Kingdom Hearts at their theme parks.
Yeah.
I mean, they shared the IP with Square, Enix, the video game company, which would be wild to see some like Final Fantasy characters wandering around Disney World. but yeah, that is Kingdom Hearts.
Yeah, I had heard of Kingdom Hearts and I just forgot that that was a thing.
I imagine since your family is rather into Disney, I imagine your kids and probably you would enjoy the Kingdom Hearts games.
Yeah, we should probably look into that. We also are waiting for, apparently Disney Dreamlight Valley is supposed to become free after they get out of like the early access phase. I just can't bring myself to pay $30 for something that's going to be free in a year.
Yeah, Disney can afford to give away something for free.
Yeah. I get it. But it'll be Animal Crossing-ish, but with Disney characters. So, yeah. All right. Kingdom Hearts. I'll remember it next time.
All right. Question 4. The poem is, I felt a funeral in my brain. I felt a funeral in my brain and mourners to and fro kept treading till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as all the heavens were a bell, and being but an ear, and I and silence, some strange race, wrecked, solitary, here. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down, and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing. Then. That's it, and it ends with a dash. Ooh. So the question is, the most attended funeral in history, with a reported 15 million attendees, occurred in 1969 in what country? Some of history's other large funerals also occurred there, for a former prime minister in 1964 and for a fallen civil rights leader in 1948.
All right. The question is, what country?
Yeah.
Okay. And the 1969 is for someone royal?
I did not say that.
Okay. So that may or may not be correct. Most attended funeral in history, 1969. Huh. I'm having a hard time working it out. I'm going to say the UK.
It is not the UK. It is India.
Oh, of course it is.
So this funeral was state funeral for E.N. Anadurai, or Kanjivaram Natarajan Anadurai, who he was a politician. He was the fourth and last chief minister of the Madras state and the first of the state of Tamil Nadu. And apparently he was just well-loved because he had 15 million people reportedly.
That's wild. I'm not sure I have learned his name.
Even, no, I'd never heard it either. Yeah, I assumed it was going to be some name that I knew. 1.5 million in 1964 attended the funeral of Jawaharlal Nehru, and reportedly about 2 million people, or at least 2 million people, were at the 1948 Gandhi funeral.
Yeah.
I assumed Gandhi would have been like the biggest one.
You would think, right?
Yeah, but like 15 million for this guy. So, yes. Okay, let's see. You are at...
Still at 20.
Oh, you're at 20 points. Oh, no, yeah. I'm so sorry.
No. No need to apologize. I'm sorry for missing your questions.
That's okay. The next poem is I Taste a Liquor Never Brewed. I taste a liquor never brewed from tankards scooped in pearl. Not all the Frankfurt berries yield such an alcohol. Inebriate of air am I, and debauchee of dew, reeling through endless summer days from inns of molten blue. When landlords turn the drunken bee out of the foxglove's door, when butterflies renounce their drams, I shall but drink the more. Till seraphs swing their snowy hats and saints to windows run to see the little tippler leaning against the sun. The question here. The beverage I am asking about actually was brewed, so the poem isn't exactly applicable, but it hasn't been regularly produced since 2008. Introduced in 1993, Zima was a clear, lightly carbonated malt beverage, about 5% in alcohol. It was marketed as an alternative to beer, which my relatives always laughed about when we would go to the brewery for a tour. Which brewing company produced Zima?
I have no idea.
I will tell you, it's one of the big ones.
Okay.
So you're not trying to like figure out this microbrew from the 90s. Like,
right. No. I'm just imagining Zima produced by a microbrewery. Budweiser is coming to mind, but I'm second guessing myself about whether Budweiser is Colorado based. I'm just going to go with it. I'm going to say Budweiser.
I'm sorry, it is Coors.
Coors was the backup I had in mind. Coors, all right.
Cold as the Rockies.
Yep.
By the end, they were like giving away cases of Zima because nobody wanted to buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Coors.
I remember seeing Zima advertisements when I was a kid. Yeah, that's a bummer. Should have gone Coors. Emily should have gone Coors. Oh, well.
All right, well, you have 20 points before the final. And I'll tell you, the poem for the final is My Life Had Stood a Loaded Gun.
I mean, I guess I'd better wager all of them, right? Like, let's just wager all of them.
Sure. All right, so the poem is, My life had stood a loaded gun in corners till a day the owner passed, identified, and carried me away. And now we roam in sovereign woods, and we hunt the doe, and every time I speak for him, the mountains straight reply. And do I smile such cordial light upon the valley glow? It is as a Vesuvian face had let its pleasure through. And when at night, our good day done, I guard my master's head, 'tis better than the eater's duck, deep pillow to have shared. To foe of his, I'm deadly foe, none stir the second time, on whom I lay a yellow eye or an emphatic thumb. Though I than he may longer live, he longer must than I. For I have but the power to kill without the power to die. So, question is, loaded guns have featured prominently in the news as of late. In case you need to know this when arguing with a quote-unquote adult, the Armalite Company was the original manufacturer of what semi-automatic rifle?
Semi-automatic rifle. I have a feeling I'm going to zero. I'm trying to think if there's a particular news story that I should be thinking of. There are so many.
Really, like, yeah, really, it's the fact that there are so many.
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking for just, like, a model.
Okay.
Right.
All right. So I keep remembering way back when we started making the podcast, I had some like AK question and AR. It's sounding right. Like A for Armalite, R for rifle. I really don't know anything about guns. I'm going to guess AR and yeah.
That is incomplete.
Oh,
so there needs to be more added on to it.
All right, they are. It's probably a number, right? I was trying to not being too specific, but also AR. Is it 15? AR-15. That's the guess.
That is correct.
What? No, it's not.
AR-15.
That can't. Yeah. That can't possibly be correct. I don't know anything about guns.
And you figured it out. AR stands for Armalite Rifle.
Okay.
And the old model was AR-10. current model is the AR-15. It is the gun that has featured prominently in discussions of assault weapon bans, particularly because it has featured prominently in assaults using weapons. And yeah, it is the civilian gun of choice for, I realize that we don't want to get too political on the podcast, but for civilians who want to kill other people.
Yeah.
The number of times I have heard in arguments about, like, nobody needs an AR-15. Mm-hmm. You don't use it for hunting. Its only purpose is to kill humans. Like, nobody needs that. And Second Amendment defenders or whatever being like, oh, I bet you don't even know what AR stands for. So in case you ever find yourself in a discussion there and the, you know, and it comes up.
It stands for Armalite rifle.
It stands for Armalite rifle. It doesn't stand for assault rifle or whatever it is. Because they feel like that's a gotcha.
That's a,
throw that in their face and be like, I do know what it stands for, and it doesn't matter. I realize I wrote this question, and I'm getting myself worked up.
It's worth getting worked up about.
Anyway. Hey, you got it. You got 40 points.
Hey, look at that recovery.
Yes.
All right. Well, this was fun, as always. Thank you. And thank you, listeners, for spending your time with us. And sorry for the background noise. We had some things come up this weekend, and we are recording it not our usual time.
Right.
Yeah. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a rating or a review if you would. If you want to check out our Patreon, it's patreon.com/potentpotables. And if you have friends who are Jeopardy fans, let them know about us.
You can all find us on Facebook at Potent Potables, on Twitter at potentpotables1. Our email address is potentpotablescast@gmail.com, and our website is potentpod.com.
And we'll be back next week with another week of Jeopardy. And until then, may your minds be quick and your buzzers be quicker.